I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Thank you all so much for coming tonight. It's a cold night and we appreciate you being here. Delighted to welcome Lavinia Greenlaw to talk about her new essay collection, The Vast Extent, published by Faber and Faber. She also has a new selected poems out at the same time, which we have on sale as well. And a nice moment to say congratulations on your new post as Faber Poetry Editor as well.
Yeah.
Which is incredibly exciting news. So congratulations all around. Thank you. Also thanks to Jennifer Higgy, who will be speaking to Lavinia today, author of The Mirror and the Palette and The Other Side. We've got early copies of The Other Side in paperback tonight as well, if you want to grab that. Very exciting. Thank you. Thanks for listening to me. I will get out the way, not before I welcome our guests. Thank you both so much. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks very much, Claire. And thank you very much to the London Review of Books Bookshop for having us tonight. I'm really excited to talk to Lavinia this evening. I'm so bowled over by her book. It's been an incredible education reading it for the last 2 weeks. I've had to take so many notes because I couldn't possibly hold it all in my brain. And so the book is The Vast Extent, On Seeing and Not Seeing Further. And it opens with a quote by John Locke from 1689 from his essay concerning human understanding. And it's something of a challenge in a way that Lavinia sets up, that the comprehension of our understandings comes exceeding short of the vast extent of things. A very beautiful quote. And so before I ask Lavinia some questions, we thought it would be good for her to actually read a passage from the book to give you a sense of its many rich layers and references. Yeah.
Okay, hello everyone. Thank you very much for being here and thank you to Claire and Gail and everyone at the shop, and thank you particularly to Jennifer for agreeing to do this. I'm going to read an extract from an essay called The Body Open Itself. And just to give you an idea of how these essays work, it starts with Rachel Whiteread's house, then it talks about the displacement of the 18th century surgeon John Hunter's coffin. And then we go to illness and John Berryman, my parents meeting in the dissection room at St. Thomas's, John Burgess, fortunate man, my grandfather's early plastic surgery in the First World War from a bullet wound to the mouth. And then we get to me and how I broke my arm and why I can't see very well. And I wanted to read you that bit, not because it's about me, but because I think it says something about how my vision was formed. When I broke my arm, I discovered what it was like to carry part of yourself around. It was past midnight in winter, and I was cycling home and lost my balance. I was so surprised that I did nothing to cushion the fall. It seemed to happen very slowly, my body falling sideways, my reflexes seemingly asleep. The ball of my shoulder broke in three places. From that moment, my arm became other. I had the sensation of being attached to something that had nothing to do with me. In the same instant, I stopped being able to see. It was as if I was so busy elsewhere in my body that I forgot to look. I could hear a voice asking if they should call an ambulance, and my own voice reassuring them that there was no need. The voice reached out and helped me up and handed me my bike, which I pushed the last mile home with my left hand, while my right arm tucked itself against my body. I couldn't see the next person to speak to me, who took my bike and pushed it for me, then took my keys and opened my front door, nor the taxi driver who arrived to take me to hospital, or the medical team who moved me through rooms and machines and put pills in my mouth and morphine in my arm. Because I have no visual memory, it is the voices that have stayed with me, that and the occasional touch of a kind hand. The pain arrived, and I spent some weeks lying beside this part of myself as it restored communication with the rest of me. We experience our bodies through the sensations within them. For me, pain is foremost, because from youth I have experienced pain that is not easily relieved and which over time has established itself as an alien part. I have felt it as a pulsar, a sinkhole, a vice or drill, a spear, bubbling tarmac, a boulder, an anchor. If you have experienced chronic pain, your nerves can become hypervigilant. The slightest inflammation triggers a cascade of reactions as the body says, "I know what this is." The mind does this too, developing acuity to the point of prescience as a form of defense. If you grow up in a volatile environment and the bad things happen to people you love, you learn to see as much as you can as quickly as possible. You react almost ahead of the event so as to defend yourself against its impact. You appear not to be present when really you have set off into the future looking desperately for whatever will equip you to escape. We perceive ourselves as both within and without, and the body is something we have rather than are. Alfred North Whitehead spoke of the withness of the body, a phrase that has been taken up by artists in the same way as dark light. So I talked earlier about dark light, but the withness of the body is a title of a poem by Anne Carson and an album by Laurie Anderson. And I think it was, I can't remember dark light, but Eigen Graus, section 25, that was it. Back to Alfred. Alfred North Whitehead spoke of the withness of the body, a phrase that has been taken up by artists in the same way as dark light, perhaps because of its making a whole out of something that by definition is in parts. We cannot become completely ourselves, even though, as Whitehead put it, no one ever says, "Here am I, and I have brought my body with me." If Whitehead had been a teenage girl, he might have reconsidered. I felt as if I were hauling myself around for years. My eyes began to fail when I was 12. The world had become fuzzy and contracted, and I hadn't noticed or didn't care, or perhaps even welcomed these new limits. I entered a phase of rudeness and dependency, tripping over everything because my eyes were fixed not even on, but beyond the horizon. Glasses were an embarrassment, while contact lenses were irritating, easily dislodged, and expensive to replace. I would stay out all night and put my lenses in egg cups that got washed up or glasses of water that got drunk. Life was hazardous, but not stressful. Once I was making my way home in the morning, having lost my lenses again, when I saw a bus and ran to catch it, only to realise it was a bus shelter. They were the same grey-green. I also once flagged down a milk float. If I was in town, there were many buses. I got on the first that came along and then asked what number it was. My understanding of light begins in fractured auras and halos, leaky shifting colours and granulated shapes that might or might not become clear. I'm never surprised to find out that something is not what it seems. I expect it. Myopia is where I became interested in perception as faulty and subjective, and in why we need to create fixed pictures when they are so evidently provisional. Max von Laue said that theoretical physics arises from deep felt need to perfect the physical world picture in the sense of its unity. It's not enough to be able to name the parts of the world. We want to know how they fit together. In pursuing this, we've realized we are not a natural priority. We've traced connection and reaction, dynamics and symbiotics, and have begun to grasp the extent to which the poor, silly humans are in the way. But the desire to perfect the picture extends to ourselves. We want to be reassured that we too are unities. It is how we see the body as a distinct outline among other outlines, regardless of how plastic and porous it really is. If you perfect the picture, everything is in place. But when you see your internal organs on a scan, they're moving. The parts are always moving. The impulse to mend the broken form, to set the engine running again, to restore the flow, is a desire for wholeness that is there in a scientist like Hunter's drive to make the world known and visible. For a long time, the body was believed to be stream and fire and earth and air together. How can we ever see ourselves amidst this flux? Not only do our bodies change, but how we see them depends on our mood, the light, the mirror, and what we hope for or fear in our reflection. These days, we can watch ourselves having a conversation, an experience that seems to make us either disintegrate or disconnect. When I see myself on screen like this, I can't form an overall impression and simply get on with being present. I cannot take myself in a general way. I see only parts. Thank you.
Really wonderful, Lavinia. And that small excerpt will give you a sort of glimpse of the depths that this book ranges around. And I mean, in many ways, it's, I think in early on in the book, you describe it as an exploded essay. Mm. And it's also something of a fever dream almost in parts, you know, because of the way it ranges in time back and forward between poetry and physics and philosophy and art and travel. And it's a memoir and it's an elegy. It's a meditation on life and death and perception and looking and art and literature. I mean, it goes off in so many strands. And I've just got some of the references here. You mentioned Dürer and Galileo and Peter de Hoogh, Freya Stark, Fierce Selmans, F. Scott Fitzgerald, Charlotte Gilman, Peter Pan, Crystal Gale's hair and Elizabeth Bishop's poetry. I mean, and that's only a tiny fraction of it. So I guess the obvious question is, how did this book come into being? What is its evolution?
It took 10 years and I started it around the time I turned 50 and had a sense that I wanted to try to consolidate my preoccupations, to sort of think about what I thought about and how I thought about it or something like that. And I tried to write essays and failed, like normal conventional essays, in the same way that I failed exams because I could not follow one line and say this is the beginning and this is the end. And I think why I responded so strongly to poetry when I discovered it, because I think in that kind of component way that there are parts and they light each other and inform each other, and that's about as coherent as something is going to get, perhaps. And for the first few years of trying to write this, I just was trying to find a form and a form that I could trust to be, this sounds paradoxical, but to be coherent, you know, not just to be a kind of, and to make something of itself that was more than the parts, more than the sum of the parts. And the phrase I landed on was exploded essay, because what they are is me going back to how ideas form and how my thoughts become ideas and my ideas become poems, really, that you're thinking about one thing and it connects to something else and something else comes in. And only out of that alignment do you see what you're trying to write about. And I wanted to kind of honour that in the form the essays took, and also to work deeply into myself having written over the last 30 years and and think about that as well. Not kind of bring things up to date and refresh them, but to sort of look at things I've thought about for a very long time.
Yes. So really it's a culmination of about 30 years of thinking.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there's a couple of suitcases of notebooks.
yeah, I bet. And it's interesting that you just mentioned, you know, a paradox, because I think there are paradoxes that weave in and out of the text. And even in the beginning, in the foreword, you say, you know, in a way you sum up what the book is about, if you can possibly do that, and you say, how do we make sense of what we see? How do we describe what we have never seen before? And I'm interested in the things that help us see more clearly, especially interruption and disruption. Mm-hmm. And that really sort of stopped me in my tracks. And then that sentence finishes with, and those that persuade us to see what's not there. So A, how do you see what's not there? And how does disruption help you see more clearly?
Can I turn those round and please start with disruption? Yeah. Because, well, I talk in the book about Francis Bacon and his description of broken knowledge and wonder that there's that moment, at the moment when you reach the limits of your own knowledge and there's a split second before the brain rushes in and explains something to you, when you see something as if you've never seen it before, if you're lucky. Mm. And that is the sharpest moment of vision to me. And what I crave, that sense of absolute empty-eyed wonder. But it is pretty much impossible, really, to achieve that. And so I think I look at those moments where it's difficult to see, or it's stressful to see, or I've only seen something out of the corner of my eye or across my vision, because naturally my mind moves to follow that thing rather than the thing that's right in front of me, to try to make sense of it, to try to complete it. And the problem is that whatever we're looking at, our brain is explaining to us in terms of what it already knows. So you can never describe the unknown other than in terms of the familiar. So we're constantly living in this point of tension where we can't really see anything new, because our brain wouldn't be able to see it unless it had seen something like it already and could describe it. Mm. Please forgive me, any neuroscientists who are here, because I'm sure I'm really oversimplifying this. But that's kind of it. Difficulty in seeing, making us try to see more carefully, and the conundrum of trying to be able to see clearly. And we do see what's not there because our brain rushes in to say what you are seeing is the green painting on the wall that's been there for 30 years, and suddenly you realise the green painting's gone, but you saw it because it's always been there.
I mean, seeing in that sense weaves in and out of the book, both literally and metaphorically. Mm-hmm. It's what you have seen in your life, like physically in front of you, and what you have seen in a perceptual manner. Mm-hmm. And throughout the book, there are lots of conversations with scientists. And, you know, I'm the least scientific person on earth. But I found it really interesting that you were sort of filtering your understanding of fiction or literature or philosophy or art through, you were sort of trying to grapple with it with a scientific framework. And throughout the book, there are lots of conversations with scientists. And there are these quite, I found them quite entertaining, these little, these tiny little dialogues. Like, for example, this one was with a Professor Fletcher, and Lavinia said, how do we know what we're looking at is real? And the professor replied, well, generally, I don't think we do. And then another professor, Blakemore, said, how we see the world, he divided the world into how we see the world versus how we process it. And yeah, I'd love to hear more of your thoughts about why you felt the need to go to scientists to try and understand what you were seeing or what you were understanding.
Well, I felt if I was writing about vision, I should try better to understand how it worked. Mm. And I wanted to, when I was at the Courtauld, I worked on, I had this sort of idea of the empty metaphor, you know, this perfect moment where your brain, the thing I just described about your brain moving to see something, but not yet investing it with what you already know. So kind of outline of a metaphor that's empty. But I do understand that that is an impossible moment. And I wanted to talk to a neuroscientist who could explain proprioception and how the brain moves to explain in terms of what it already knows and how that dominates our vision, but actually how also our vision depends on it. But I also wanted to experience more directly how scientists think, because I've been described since my first book as someone who writes about science. I don't. My family, including those who are here, are doctors and scientists, and I would never say I write about science. Science can lend itself in terms of metaphor, and metaphor certainly lends itself to science, but I would never say that I write about science. I think what I write about is an impulse towards inquiry, towards investigation, and towards attempts to describe, which we might align with scientific inquiry. I think we have some shared imperatives, but from the first step, they become extremely different things with different criteria. Mm. And the conversation I have in the book with Professor Blakemore is great, because at one point he says, "This sounds rather poetic." And I really bristled at first, but then I slowed myself down and listened to him, and I could hear exactly that his thinking was coming from such a different place. So when I talked, it was when I said, when we're trying to see in the dark, are we being passive or active? Are we looking or seeing? And he found that question poetic, and I was quite proud of that question, and I thought it was an interesting one. But for a scientist, they would have to unpack so much around physiology and neurology in order to really answer that. But he taught me a lot in that conversation, and so I went and had other conversations, and I asked them about uncertainty in their process. I didn't really want their grand theories of anything, even if they, I wanted to hear how they thought about approaching and finding what they were doing.
And when you spoke with, I think it was the Czech physicist,
Miroslav Holub, who is also immunologist and poet.
Yeah, yes. And how was his understanding the world, being a poet himself? Did that differ much from the other scientists who weren't poets?
Well, he was remarkable, I mean, because he really was a leading immunologist and an international leading poet. And a very important figure for me. And his poems, if you haven't read them, Miroslav Holub, H-O-L-U-B, they're very much within a certain mid-20th century former Eastern Europe sort of tradition, and they are fantastically easy to read and quite folkloric on the surface, and often very funny. And but they are kind of metaphysically acute.
I mean, poetry, understandably, weaves in and out the text as well. I mean, there's a huge range of poets who are mentioned, but I kept seeing Elizabeth Bishop's name, and she kept returning. And you described her as someone who liked fanatics and relished the everyday, which I thought was wonderful. And then you write, "What she shares to a remarkable degree is how she sees. Her best poems are landscapes into which the human experience has been dissolved, or panoramic accounts of an animal knitted into the fabric of its place, such as the armadillo or the moose."
Yeah, I mean, Elizabeth Bishop is a very different poet to me, but she has been a very important poet to me because her seeing is live action. She will say in the poem, "It looks like this." "No, it doesn't. It looks like that." And she will allow for that in a way that in other hands can come across as sort of a bit theatrical or romantic even. But she does it in such a sort of practical way, in the same way that she will reach for a metaphor that might bring the whole poem kind of crashing down to earth, but is exactly right. She just has a kind of willingness to set aside elegance or kind of,
artiness, maybe.
Artiness. She was a great artist as well. She was a good, she was a great painter, good painter, watercolorist, very interesting. But I think that the way she sees and the kind of ability to be precise, but to incorporate within that precision, the provisional, was something that I found was
I'd like important. To ask you a sort of slightly ridiculous question, but
I like ridiculous questions.
Which is, what do poets offer your understanding of the world that science doesn't?
Well, I think both. I mean, science, I'm not a scientist, so science hasn't given me the experience of precision that poetry has. Poetry has taught me precision, for sure, because poetry has taught me that there is a way of formulating and articulating experience that, I'm going to be repeating myself, but that is as close as you can get to the variables and contingencies of experience without just making the whole thing vague. And to use the word in the way that some people do that drives me a bit nuts, poetic, but with inverted commas, because poetic is not the same as poetic.
Yes. I actually, when I was a sort of budding writer and I wrote a piece for Frieze magazine and then editor James Roberts sent it back full of like red lines. It was so embarrassing. But I described an artwork. I'm so embarrassed now to say this, but I described it as poetic. And he underlined it with a heavy red pen and went, "What poem?" And I thought yeah. that was, and I never, yeah. I literally have never used the word again. Yeah. And without being precise about it.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I thought that was a very good lesson. But actually, your earliest poem you write in your book was about radium.
One of my early poems, really early, actually. Yes, I was still, I think that was when I was going to a workshop. I had a 10-week-old baby and I spent my last maternity benefit check on a workshop at the Old Poetry Society in Earls Court. And I could kind of run there between feeds once a week. And so I was all over the place, but I was really sort of caught up in this idea of it was just, yeah, the right time for poetry. And the radium poem is a story. It's a lot of the stories in the book and the references will be fairly general, you know, fairly familiar to a lot of people because they are core. And this one is the story of the women who worked in the luminous clock factory in Jersey using radium-based luminous paint and were dying of its effects. And the whole thing was hushed up and it became a big union case to kind of get them justice. But for me, it was the kind of fable elements of it around seeing that I was interested in. I wrote a poem that is not the poem I would write now. It's a young poem. but I wouldn't write the poem now, actually. I'd be too scared of, I mean, the story glows. It has its own glow. It doesn't need a poem about it.
Because the story is both sort of enchanting about these radium girls, they were called, but it's also horrific because they were being killed by the very thing that was supposedly giving them a living.
And they used to dip the brush in the paint and lick it. And I think the most chilling thing was one of them saying it tasted of nothing. I thought that's the whole problem, is it looks and feels and is thought to be nothing. And you're taking it into your body and decorating your nails with it so they shine in the dark and your teeth.
Light is another constant theme in the book. And you quoted the wonderful Frank O'Hara, the New York poet. What is this light that holds us fast? And, you know, again, you use it as something that is literal, that can illuminate a painting or illuminate a room, or you talk about caves which are deprived of light or shadows which are about the effects of light. And I'd love to hear about the evolution of your thinking around light.
How long have we got?
10 minutes.
10 minutes, evolution of light. I think I basically write about light and water. I really do. I mean, you know, people often say, what do you write poems about? And I generally say cats and sunsets because it's easier than saying what I really write about, which is actually light and water. I think that, I mean, the O'Hara is from a poem with a reference to cinema, and it's the opening essay in the book where I talk about a day I was exhausted because I was moving house and thought, I'm just going to go and live in a cave. And I thought, there's a cinema, I'm going to go in and watch whatever's on. And it was a film about a cave. And it was... and so I was thinking about caves and cinemas and how we observe the world from within the dark. And that was really the first essay I wrote and sort of gave me the shape of things for this book. But again, you see, it's about difficulty. It's about being tired. It's about not knowing what to do or what to look at and then something happening. I think the best moments in a writer's life is when something kind of bursts open in your mind that you had no idea about, not the thing you're straining after, like when you're actually writing and that happens. And you think, I didn't think about that at all. I've no idea. The fever dream moments.
I mean, it is a book that is filled with wonder in a way at the many levels that we exist in the world and what the world can offer us. And at one point you talk about the difference between curiosity and wonder. Mm. You know, you bring your poet's precision to the difference between these two words. Could you elaborate a little on that?
I mean, that was something that I learned a lot about through my work at the Courtauld about. I was taught about the difference between curiosity and wonder. And how with curiosity is you saying, let me tell you about this interesting thing I found. Look, I brought it home. Here it is. Isn't it curious? And wonder is when the world is doing that to you and you are the little thing and you just kind of don't know how to receive what you're encountering. And there's a kind of wonderful whiteout, which I think for all the sort of desire for words and images and thoughts and ideas, the sort of actual nirvana is the sort of complete whiteout, wonder, speechlessness. That's my ambition always.
Silence.
Reaching a point where there's nothing to describe, nothing to say, nothing to think about, just being.
In a way, that's what painting does.
Yes. You know,
it's silent. And I kept thinking about that as I was reading your book, because you mentioned so many different painters and various paintings, and of course they're silent objects. A painting is obviously an imprecise science. It can never be fully defined. It's eternally changeable in a way in terms of whoever's looking at it or whatever period it finds itself in. And so you studied, I think, Netherlandish paintings, 17th century. And so how has that impacted on the way you look at our contemporary world?
Well, it made me think about exactly what you've said about the strange thing with artworks, where they have their autonomy and their existence. So we look at something 500 years old and we know that all those variables come into it, that the time and place. I mean, I write about Lucretia and Lucretia as, you know, was it 47 Lucretias that Cranach the Elder painted? And I follow one of them to auction, and then I look at a Gentileschi, Artemisia Gentileschi, Lucretia, and just think about the image and the silence of the image and how our anxiety around how we receive things now is kind of countered by the autonomy of a completed image. And it's the same in the poem. There's that lovely moment where you know an image has settled in a poem because you have nothing to say about it and you could not describe it. It's formed and it can be received by the reader bodily in the way that a painting can. And I think I write about painting because I always wished I could be a painter.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Ah. Just, I mean, you know, not words, really.
Just... Words. Says the poet.
Well, no, words are so overwhelming and they get really boring. And
it's funny, isn't it, how hard we work to achieve a silence with thousands of words. Yeah, absolutely. In terms of this distinction between your precision with the way you use words, you also talk about the movement between the contingent and the absolute. And that was a sentence I was really... thinking about too. What did you mean by that? I mean, I feel like
I don't know where that is, but I'm trying to. What was I talking about?
You describe sorry, as the movement between the contingent and
what
the absolute.
Do I describe as the
I
movement?
Can't remember. I haven't got included the sentence before. These are my bad
then
notes.
I have no idea.
And then I followed it up with Ray, the benefits of being unsettled. There. So
I'm sorry, that sounds like the whole book is about those
at
things.
At that point.
I think they're sort of, the benefits of being unsettled. There is a chapter about elsewhere and travel because I'm a terrible traveller, but I know it's good for me. Mm. and I feel it's good for me when I come home and I'm excited when I'm there, but I still find it difficult. Mm. I think,
Actually, there's a lot of humour in the book as well, especially when you seem to get on a lot of tour buses. Yeah, like when you go to the Getty Museum look at the mouse.
That's my only tour. There's the tour bus that goes to Maeshowe. When I went back after 20 years and it had become a tourist site, that's a Neolithic burial chamber in Orkney. Yeah. And in the 20 years between my two trips, it had been transformed into a tourist place. And you're talking about the Starlight Tour in Los Angeles that took in the Getty Museum and Homes of the Famous.
Great
and
combo.
Much to my disappointment, there was a very unusual weather event, a massive storm, and they cancelled the visit to the Homes of the Famous.
But you did get to see the 17th century mouse.
I got in touch with the Getty because I wanted to see this particular illumination that I had studied that they hold. And they said, the three people allowed to turn the pages are all going to be away when you come. So we can't show you the book, but we can show you, we've got very good high-res images. So I settled for that. And when I arrived, they said, and the reason I was on the tour bus was it was the simplest way to get from one side of Los Angeles to the other. And everyone else got off at the film studios, and I was the one person still on the bus, and it pulled up at the Getty. And then they said, oh, Professor Greenlaw, how did you get here today? And I said, oh, the Starlight Tour, the Starlight bus tour, and we're going off to look at the Homes of the Famous. But that became an essay really about because what would have happened if I had gone to the Homes of the Famous? I'd have been looking at a hedge or a wall or a gate. Mm. So that desire to see and make contact, as I wanted to with this ancient mouse in the picture or with a celebrity.
Mm. Why did you want to see the mouse again?
Because I'd written about it in the context, in the work I'd done on an artist called Jacques Dechaine. And this mouse was part of the illustration of a book of calligraphy, which Emperor Rudolf II had asked an artist to add images to. And the images quite radically overtook and dominated the calligraphy. And it was at that point where the post-iconoclasm, where the natural world was coming out of the margins, marginalia, and becoming the centre. So it was sort of thinking around all of that stuff, really.
And then the irony of going all that way to then look at it as a very high-res image, which in a way would be clearer than maybe looking at the original because it's been blown up slightly.
Yeah, I mean, I try to describe that experience of sinking into the image, even when you know it's not really the image.
I think this quote might be from that essay, but who knows? You can tell me. I've got written here, the danger of seeing so clearly, we unravel.
Yeah, that might be from there.
That sounds a bit high res, doesn't it?
Yeah. It could be from the bus trip, I don't know.
You also discuss a lot about how things are made and how they work, like the physical components of them.
Yes, I think that's a poet's drive. Mm. I think poets do want to know how things work, whether it's an illusion or a feeling or a sky or, a clock. You kind of do. You just want to be able to understand. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. And music is another theme that weaves in and out. So you talk about Fingal's Cave and Mendelssohn and who else was it who wrote about? Oh, and Turner painted Fingal's Cave.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you talk about Benjamin Britten and pop songs and this is another, obviously many songs are made of words, but they also have a kind of silence because you can't really reproduce the joy of a song.
No. And what you're making me think about is, so with Mendelssohn, it's an example of how things talk to each other. Art talks to art, sort of regardless of who made it and who's looking at it. And I was interested in going to Fingal's Cave because I had found, I'd been thinking about, Mendelssohn for some reason. And I had also been doing some work on something else in Liverpool and had been looking at the old, the very early railway tunnels that went down to the docks there. And I then found out that Mendelssohn, having been on Staffa and gone to Fingal's Cave, and if you've ever been to Fingal's Cave, it's formed out of basalt columns and looks very like a railway station.
Where is it again?
It's on an island called Staffa off coast of West Scotland. And he went there and was incredibly seasick. I went there, I was incredibly seasick. but then I found out that he came back through Liverpool and was bored. I think this chapter is quite a lot about boredom and repetition. And he went into the tunnel and asked the watchman if he could ride on the engine down to the dock. And he describes, Mendelssohn describes, the engine's momentum being all its own on a slope, but going faster than he could have imagined. And he said, for the first time, I saw nothing. And it was that thing of suddenly being accelerated into a new experience. And when I read that and thought about his Fingal's Cave Overture, I kind of felt that even though he's, as far as I know, and if you know, please tell me, which is partly why I'm telling this story, because I want someone to tell me, did Mendelssohn ever say anything about that connected his journey through the tunnel in Liverpool with his journey into Fingal's Cave? Because they really sing to each other as experiences, as perceptual experiences. And I feel that he kind of repeated the journey into the cave in the journey into the tunnel. And that kind of repeated gesture helps you crystallize what it is you want to express in the art that you're making. So, and often you don't realize for years that that repetition has happened. So sorry to divert you, but no, I want to find somebody who can tell me categorically if Mendelssohn ever said anything about that.
Yeah.
But that desire to see nothing, for the first time I saw nothing. Yeah.
We're getting to the point where we might ask people for questions, but I'd like to finish up with one last question. And, you know, I mean, this is such an extraordinary act of concentration, this book, and research and journeys, literal and metaphorical. Do you feel like you answered some of the questions posed by Locke at the beginning, or rather the statement that with the vast extent
it's
limitless?
That there is much more than we will ever see. Yeah. We will not see further. I don't think I answered any questions. I think I've tried to travel questions and get behind questions. My last book was about questions, some answers without questions. And I kind of pose this approach of traveling a question and looking at the question behind the question. And I think writing that book gave me the confidence to kind of draw this all finally together.
And to read your poetry alongside this book, can you see correspondences like with certain subjects? I mean, obviously there are big ones like light or perception, but it's did all one help the other?
Yeah, they're all part of the same, brain. they're all me.
They absolutely
kind of work across each other. There are poems about some of the things like radium in this book.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Wonderful. Would anyone like to ask Lavinia any questions. Claire's got the microphone, so yeah.
Hello, thank you for speaking to us today. I have sort of two hopefully short questions. First being, in your conversations with neuroscientists, did the topic of computer vision ever come up in your conversations with neuroscientists or other scientists?
Computer vision.
Yeah.
I've never heard of it.
It's just when robots see rather than humans see.
No, I decided not to go too far. Okay. Because no, but that would be a fascinating thing to look at.
And just another short question is, when you speak about sight and vision, do you touch on the idea of distance and time? So if you look at the stars, you're looking back in history.
Very much.
Yeah, I write about things like the early experiences of the motor car and being in the air, and also how a 17th century Dutch artist was not painting from an aerial view they could never attain, and things like that. So distance and space are integral to the vision. Yeah. Mm.
Yeah. I'm not sure if this is a question or a thought, but when you say that how we see depends on what we have seen, and so it's hard to see something anew, and I was thinking about social media at the moment, and we're seeing so much, but also not, because it's all through an algorithm and curated, and it kind of like cannibalizes itself. And then I thought, are we potentially at a point where we're going to see less and less as kind of we proceed, now we're in this new age of like connectivity and social media? It's not really a question. I just wanted to know your thoughts on social media.
That's really interesting.
I think that's a great question.
Are we seeing less and less as we see
more and more?
But it is mediated and etiolated and all of that. I mean, I don't know about you, but after lockdown, the first thing I wanted to do was to have direct contact with, stand in front of a painting and have direct contact with art. And also, it surprised me, I wanted direct contact with humans as well. I decided I quite liked the humans and being in their company. Mm. But it'll be interesting to see how it evolves, because we're not where we'll be in some entirely different place, won't we, in 20 years' time. But you put it really well. Thank you.
Mm. Yeah.
Thank you very much. I wanted another phrase from Locke, which I thought of reading your book, is from his letter on education, when he talks about knowledge as openness to the world, openness through sensation to the world. So it's a wonderful description of being open through sensation to the world. And when you talk about social media and so on, I thought that there seemed to be some kind of link between the different ages there. But also, I wondered, when you talked about metaphor and science particularly, it was fascinating because I thought a lot about neuroscience and the connection between how you describe the experience of your own brain working, if it's in distress or something's gone wrong with it. So, for example, I have Parkinson's, and I have it's been explained to me by doctors millions of times of what exactly is wrong with me, but the way I described it to the doctor was I felt like a radio, that my brain felt like a radio that couldn't be turned off. And then when I discovered that the cure, I had a deep brain stimulation operation, and it turned out that that was to put waves in my brain that were a bit like radio. And it seemed like there's a sense in which, even if you're not a scientist, you somehow, there's a kind of instinctive way in which language can anticipate through metaphor what science is doing. Because I feel a lot of, when I talk to scientists, they don't really know why it works, and they use it for different things, quite a variety of things. So I just wondered if in a way language, there's a kind of uncanny way in which it kind of can foresee or precipitate what might be the cure for your mental state or something.
There's so much in what you've just said, Elizabeth. Thank you very much. And very expertly said as well. So it's made me think about three things at once. The first was thinking about the social media and thinking about Locke and the microscope and what he said about if you are the person who looks down a microscope, you see the world entirely differently to how everyone else who hasn't looked down the microscope sees it. Mm-hmm. And that idea of bringing lenses in, so like the screen, seeing more but mm-hmm. seeing less, or seeing less clearly. And in that wonderful certainty of vision, when you believe in God and the earth is flat and you go from here to your church and home again, has become this unravelling of stuff. And I think there is that sort of reaching across the centuries. But what you're saying about the uncanniness of language and doctors and scientists, how language can move in those ways to, I think I'm understanding this, that, your word, I need to think about your word uncanny. But I think what you're making me think about, right, I won't try and paraphrase what you've just said very well, but is how so many times I came up against myself wanting to control or finding I wanted to control an outcome of a thought or an idea, but it did something else. And how often that happened to the people in the book as well, to Locke, to Hunter, to the artists, that things, and suddenly the thing has an autonomy and language has its way of kind of reaching and solving and showing, or the body does. And we don't, as you say, that thing of not knowing because we can't describe why something works or it doesn't. Exactly. It's that weird movement between hyperconsciousness and back of the head. I mean, in teaching, which I've done for 20 years, I think it's as important to restore the connection in somebody who's thinking very hard about their writing and how to write with what comes from the back of the head as it is to teach them technique and precision and how to pursue a subject and so on. Mm. Thank you.
Any other questions at all?
Thank you. Sorry if you wanted the drink, by the way. These essays, in terms of the amount of things that you include in them, they're beautifully written, but they're also beautifully curated, the amount you managed to pack in. Jennifer's summarised the diverse range of subjects very well. So it's almost more impressive because you clearly pay deep attention to everything you talk about and you're drawing from a vast pool of memory. You obviously know a lot and you've left a lot out as well. You could have chosen any number of things. So I guess, how did you choose? How did you know what to include? How did you know what to leave out? And I suppose, because you've only got a limited amount of space, these are small essays which go on a number of subjects. How did you know when you had the essential detail that you needed?
It seemed to evolve like an archipelago, and things would arise and connect. And I worked across the essays. I didn't write one essay and then write another one. I just had this stuff coming up, and was going back to my early notebooks and so on and thinking about things. And over 10 years, they would form these groups. And there is a lot that I have left out that I wanted to include. And every now and again, I'll think, you know, like, now I want to know about robots. And, you know, there is so much more. But in the end, I was guided as I would be, but when with a poem. And the parts move around and settle and in a certain way, and you think, yes, that's it. And I also reminded myself, I think one of the reasons the book took so long is I was very tentative about even proposing it as a work, because I'm not an art historian, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a neuroscientist, I'm not a philosopher. I am no expert on anything. And I had to wait until I found the form that was true to my nature and in which I wouldn't feel that compelled to try to claim an authority or an insight that I don't naturally have. I really wanted it to be true to that. And that's why I'm slightly astonished people are interested, because it's sort of deep me. And it's lovely that people find something in it more broadly, because, of course, that's what you want anything to do, to actually be through me, not about me, even when I'm writing about me.
OK, the last question.
Last question. Did you find, as a poet, did you find that writing this book helped you towards the writing of your poetry?
Yes, the book was, so I started it in 2013 when I got a lovely welcome 3-year fellowship, the kind you'll never get again, and struggled with it. But then I went off and wrote a book of poems. So I sort of set it aside and I wrote a book of poems, which is largely about my father's disappearance into dementia. And I made a short film and then I came back. And I think thinking about the image, thinking about articulation, I think what it was encouraging me to do, which I had started with a book I wrote almost 20 years ago now about music and growing up in music, was to really be patient and trust that this thing will find its own form, and not to say it's going to be essays or fiction or memoir or whatever, but just to, what is the form this book needs to take? And I think going off and I think it released that book of poems. So it sounds like poems about dementia, but they're very small. And I just trusted each to work in a very small way, and that this could be small parts, and try to achieve a kind of lightness but resonance within them. So, yeah, whatever form my work takes, it's all part of the same murky pool, yeah.
Great. I think we'll leave it there. But thank you so much, Lavinia.
Thank you very much, Jennifer.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.